Now you've done it. By bucking my judgment on an important matter, forcing your own on me, and by being justified in the outcome. Oh, rats. I got bullheaded and forced one issue. It never occurred to you, big brains, that you were failing to consult the one real Venus expert you had on tap. Mary, I mean. But I didn't expect to find out anything. I had a lucky break. He shook his head. I don't believe in luck, Sam. Luck is a tag given by the mediocre to account for the accomplishments of genius. I placed my hands on the desk and leaned toward him. Okay, so I'm a genius. Just the same, you are not going to get me to hold a sack. When this is over, Mary and I are going up in the mountains and raise kittens and kids. We don't intend to spend our time bossing screwball agents. He smiled gently, as though he could see farther into the future than I could. I went on. I don't want your job, understand me? That is what the devil said to the deity after he displaced him. But he found he could not help himself. Don't take it so hard, Sam. I'll keep the title for the present, and give you all the help I can. In the meantime, what are your orders, sir? 31. The worst of it was, he meant it. I tried to correct matters by going limp on him, but it didn't work. A top-level conference was called late that afternoon. I was notified, but I stayed away. Shortly, a very polite little wack came to tell me that the commanding officer was waiting, and would I please come at once. So, I went, and tried to stay out of the discussion. But my father has a way of conducting any meeting he is in, even if he is not in the chair, by looking expectantly at the one he wants to hear from. It's a subtle trick, as the group does not know that it is being led. But I knew. With every eye in the room on you, it's easier to voice an opinion than to keep quiet. Particularly, as I found that I had opinions. The meeting was largely given over to moaning and groaning about the utter impossibility of using 9-day fever against the slugs. Admitted that it would kill slugs. They would even kill Venerians, who can be chopped in two and still survive. But it was sure death to any human, or almost any human. I was married to one who had survived. Death to the enormous majority. 7 days after exposure, and curtains. Yes, Mr. Nivens? It was the commanding general addressing me. I hadn't said anything, but Dad's eyes were on me. Waiting. I think there has been a lot of despair voiced at this session, I said, and a lot of opinions given that were based on assumptions. The assumptions may not be correct. Yes. I did not have an instance in my mind. I had been shooting from the hip. I continued to do so. Well, for example, I hear constant reference to 9-day fever as if the 9-day part were an absolute fact. It's not. The boss brass shrugged impatiently. It's a convenient tag. It averages 9 days. Yes, but how do you know it lasts 9 days for a slug? By the murmur with which it was received, I knew I had hit the jackpot again. A few minutes later, I was being invited to explain why I thought the fever might run a different time in slugs, and if so, why it mattered. I began to feel like the after-dinner speaker who wishes he had not gotten up in the first place. I bowled on ahead. As to the first point, I said, according to the record I saw this morning, in the only case we know about, the slug did die in less than 9 days. Quite a lot less. Those of you who have seen the records on my wife, and I gather that entirely too many of you have, are aware that her parasite left her, presumably dropped off and died, long before the 8th-day crisis. One datum does not fare a curve, but if it is true, and experiments show it to be, then the problem is very different. A man infected with a fever might be rid of his slug in, oh, call it 4 days. That gives you 5 days to catch him and cure him. The general whistled.
That's a pretty heroic solution, Mr. Nivens.
How do you propose to cure him? For that matter, how do you propose to catch him? I mean to say, suppose we do plant an epidemic of 9-day fever in Zone Red. It would take some incredibly fast footwork, in the face of stubborn resistance, remember, to locate and treat more than 50 million people before they died of the fever.
It was a hot potato, so I slung it right back.
I wondered, as I did so, how many experts made their names by passing the buck.
As to the second question, that is a logical and tactical problem.
Your problem, not mine. As to the first, there is your expert. I pointed to Dr. Hazelhurst. Ask him. Hazelhurst huffed and puffed, and I knew how he felt. Insufficient former art, more research needed, experiments would be required. He seemed to recall that some work had been done toward an antitoxin treatment, but the vaccine for immunizing had proven so successful that he was not sure the antitoxin had ever been perfected. Anyway, everyone who went to Venus nowadays was immunized before leaving. He concluded, lamely, by saying that the study of the exotic diseases of Venus was necessarily still in its infancy. The general interrupted him as he was finishing.
This antitoxin business. How soon can you find out about it?
Hazelhurst said he would get after it at once. There was a man at the Sorbonne. He wanted to phone.
Do so, the commanding officer said. You are excused.
Hazelhurst came buzzing at our door before breakfast the next morning. I was annoyed, but tried not to show it, when I stepped out into the passageway to see him.
Sorry to wake you, he said, but you were right about that antitoxin matter.
Huh?
They are sending me some from Paris. It should arrive any minute now. I do hope it's still potent.
And if it isn't?
Well, we have the means to make it. We'll have to make it, of course, if this wild scheme is used, millions of units of it.
Thanks for telling me, I said. I know the general will be pleased. I started to turn away. He stopped me.
Mr. Nivens?
Yes.
About the matter of vectors.
Vectors?
At the moment, all the word meant to me was little arrows pointing in various directions.
Disease vectors. We can't use rats or mice or anything like that. Do you happen to know how the fever is transmitted on Venus?
By a little flying rotifier, the Venerian equivalent of an insect.
But we don't have such here, and that is the only way it can be carried.
Do you mean to say you couldn't give it to me if you tried, even with a jug full of live culture?
Oh yes, I could inject you with it, but I can't picture a million paratroopers dropping into Zone Red and asking the parasite-ridden population to hold still while they gave them injections.
He spread his hands helplessly.
Something started turning slowly over in my brain. A million men in a single drop.
Why ask me? I said. It seems to be a medical problem.
Yes. It is, of course. I just thought... Well, you seem to have a ready grasp,
He paused.
Thanks. My mind was struggling with two problems at once, and beginning to have traffic problems.
How many people were there in Zone Red?
Let me get this straight. Suppose you had the fever, and I didn't. I could not catch it from you?
The drop could not be medical men. There weren't that many.
Not very easily. If I took a live smear from my throat and placed it in your throat, you might contract it. If I opened a vein of mine and made a trace transfusion into your veins, you would be sure to be infected with it.
Direct contact, huh?
How many people could one paratrooper service?
10, 20, 30, or more? If that is what it takes, you don't have a problem.
Nay?
What's the first thing one slug does when he runs across another slug he hasn't seen lately?
Conjugation.
Direct conference, I've always called it. But then I use the sloppy old slug language for it.
Do you think that would pass on the disease?
Think so, I'm sure of it. We have demonstrated right here in this laboratory that there is actual exchange of living protein during conjugation. They could not possibly escape direct transmission. We can infect a whole colony as if it were one body. Now why didn't I think of that?
His words roused a horrid memory. Something about, would my subjects had but one neck.
But I refrained from quoting it.
Don't go off half-cocked, I said. Better try it first. But I suspect that it will work.
It will. It will!
He started to go, then stopped.
Oh, Mr. Nivens, would you mind very much? I know it's a great deal to ask.
What is it? Speak up. I'm getting hungry.
Actually, I was anxious to work out the rest of the other problem. Well, would you consider permitting me to announce this method of vectoring in my report this morning?
I'll give you full credit.
But the general expects so much that this is just what I need to make my report complete.
He looked so anxious that I almost laughed.
Not at all, I said.
It's your department.
That's decent of you. I'll try to return the favor.
He turned away, feeling happy, and I turned back, feeling the same way. I was beginning to like being a genius.
I waited before reopening the door to our cubicle until I had straightened out in my mind all the main features of the big drop. Then I went in. Mary opened her eyes when I came in and gave me that long, heavenly smile. I reached down and smoothed her hair.
Howdy, Flametop. Did you know that your husband is a genius?
Yes.
You did? You never said so.
You never asked me.
Hazelhurst gave credit, all right. He referred to it as the Nivens vector. I suppose it was natural that I should be asked to comment, though Dad looked my way first.
I agree with Dr. Hazelhurst, I started out.
Subject to experimental confirmation as outlined. However, he has properly left open for discussion certain aspects which are tactical rather than medical. While it is true that the entire body of Titans might be infected from one contact, important considerations of timing, crucial, I should say. I had worked out my whole opening speech, even to the hesitations, while eating breakfast. Mary does not chatter at breakfast, thank goodness. Require vectoring from many focal points. If we are to save a nominal 100% of the population of Zone Red, it is necessary that all the parasites be infected at as nearly the same time as possible, in order that rescue squads may enter Zone Red after the slugs are no longer dangerous, and before any host has passed the point where antitoxin can save him. The problem is susceptible to mathematical analysis.
Sam, my boy, I said to myself, you old phony. You could not solve it with an electronic integrator and 20 years of sweat.
I should be turned over to your analytical section. However, let me sketch out the factors. Call the number of vector origins X. Call the number of rescue workers who must be dropped Y. There will be an infinitely large number of simultaneous solutions, with the optimum solution depending on logistic factors. Speaking in advance of rigorous mathematical treatment, I had done my very damnedest with this lipstick, but I did not mention that. And basing my opinions on my own, unfortunately, too intimate knowledge of their habits, I would intimate that they let me go right ahead. You could have heard a pin drop if anybody in that bear-skin crew had had a pin. The general interrupted me once when I placed a rather low estimate on X.
Mr. Nivens, I think we can assure you of any number of volunteers for vectoring.
I shook my head. You can't accept volunteers, General. I think I see your objection. The disease would have to be given time to establish itself in the volunteer, and the timing might be dangerously close for his safety. But I think we could get around that. A gelatin capsule with the antitoxin embedded in tissue, or something of that sort. I'm sure the staff could work it out. I thought they could, too. But I did not say that my real objection was a deep-rooted aversion to any additional human soul having to be possessed by a slug. You must not use human volunteers, sir. The slug will know everything that his host knows, and he simply will not go into direct conference. He'll warn the others by word of mouth instead. I did not know that I was right, but it sounded plausible. No, sir. We will use animals. Apes, dogs, anything large enough to carry a slug, but incapable of human speech. And in sufficient quantities to infect the whole group before any slug knows that it's sick. I went on to give a fast sketch of the final drop. Schedule Mercy, as I visualized it. We can assume that the first drop, Schedule Fever, can start as soon as we are sure that we will have enough units of antitoxin for the second drop. In less than a week thereafter, there should be no slug left alive on this continent. They did not applaud, but it felt that way. The general adjourned the meeting and hurried away to call Air Marshal Rexton, then sent his aide back to invite me to lunch. I sent word that I would be pleased provided the invitation included my wife. Otherwise, I would be unable to accept. Dad waited for me outside the conference room. "Well, how did I do?" I asked him, more anxiously than I tried to sound. He shook his head. "Sam, you wowed him. You have the makings of a politician. No, I think I'll sign you up for 26 weeks of stereo instead." I tried not to show how much I was pleased. I had gotten through the whole performance without once stammering. I felt like a new man. That ape Satan, which had wrung my heart so back at the National Zoo, turned out to be as mean as he was billed once he was free of his slug. Dad had volunteered to be the test case for the Nivens-Hazelhurst theories, but I put my foot down, and Satan drew the short straw. Dad made an issue out of it. He had some silly idea that it was up to him to be possessed by a slug, at least once. I told him we had no time to waste on his sinful pride. He grew huffy, but I made it stick. It was neither filial affection, nor its neo-Freudian antithesis that caused me to balk him. I was afraid the combination of Dad cum slug. I did not want him on their side, even temporarily, and under laboratory conditions. Not with his shifty, tricky mind. I did not know how he would manage to escape, nor what he would do to wreck our plans, but I was morally certain he would, once possessed. People who have never experienced possession, even those who have seen it, cannot appreciate that the host is utterly against us, with all his abilities intact. We could not risk having Dad against us, and I swung enough weight to overrule him. So we used anthropoid apes for the experiments. We had on hand not only apes from the National Zoological Gardens, but simian citizens from half a dozen zoos and a couple of circuses. I did not select Satan for the job. I would have let the poor beast be. The look of patient suffering on his face made one forget the slug on his back. Satan was injected with 9-day fever on Wednesday the 13th. By Friday, the fever had established. Another chimp cum slug was introduced into his cage. The two slugs immediately went into direct conference, after which the second ape was removed. On Sunday the 17th, Satan's master shriveled up and fell off, dead. Satan was immediately injected with antitoxin. Late Monday, the other slug died, and its host was dosed. By Wednesday, Satan was well, though a bit thin, and the second ape, Lord Fauntleroy, was on the road to recovery. I gave Satan a banana to celebrate, and he took off the first joint of my left index finger, and me with no time for a repair job. It was not accident, either. That ape was nasty. But a minor injury could not depress my spirits. After I had it dressed, I looked for Mary, as I wanted to crow. I failed to find her, and ended up in the mess room, wanting someone with whom to share a toast. The place was empty. Everyone in the labs, except me, was working harder than ever, mounting Schedule Fever and Schedule Mercy. By order of the President, all possible preparations were taking place in this one lab in the Smoky Mountains. The apes for vectoring, some 200 of them, were here, and both the culture and the antitoxin were being cooked here. The horses needed for serum were stalled in what had been an underground handball court. The million-plus men necessary for the scheduled mercy drop could not be here, but they would know nothing about it until alerted a few hours before the drop, at which time they would be issued a handgun and two bandoliers of individual dose antitoxin injectors. Those who had never parachuted before would not be given a chance to practice. They would each be pushed, if necessary, by some sergeant with a large foot. Everything possible was being done to keep the secret close. The only way I could see that we could lose, now that we knew that our theories worked, would be for the Titans to find out our plans, through a renegade or by whatever means. Too many good plans have failed because some fool told his wife about it in bed. If we failed to keep this secret, our ape disease vectors would never get into direct conference. They would be shot on sight, wherever they appeared in the Titan Nation. But I relaxed over my first drink, happy and reasonably sure that the secret could not leak. Traffic with the laboratory was incoming only, until after drop day, and Colonel Kelly censored or monitored all communication outward. Kelly was no fool. As for a leak from the outside, the chances were slight. The General, Dad, Colonel Gibbsy, and myself had gone to the White House the week before, there to see the President and Marshal Rexton. I had already convinced Dad that the way to keep this secret was not to share it with anybody. He put on a histrionic exhibition of belligerence and exasperation that got him what we wanted. In the end, even Secretary Martinez was bypassed. If the President and Rexton could keep from talking in their sleep for another week, I did not see how we could miss. A week would be none too soon. Zone Red was spreading. The counterattack they had launched at Pass Christian had not been stopped there. The slugs had pushed on and now held the Gulf Coast past Pensacola, and there were signs that more was to come. Perhaps the slugs were growing tired of our resistance and might decide to waste human raw material by A-bombing the cities we still held. If so, we would find it hard to stop. A radar screen can alert your defenses, but it won't stop a determined attack. But I refuse to worry about that. One more week. Colonel Kelly came in, looked around the otherwise empty room, came over and sat down beside me. "How about a drink?" I suggested. "I feel like celebrating." He examined the hairy paunch bulging out in front of him and said, "I suppose one more beer wouldn't put me in any worse shape." "Have two beers. Have four. Have a dozen." I dialed for him and told him about the success of the experiments with the apes. He nodded. "Yes, I had heard. Sounds good." "Good," the man says. "Colonel, we are on the 1 yard line and goal to go. A week from now, the game will be won." "So?" "Oh, come now," I answered, irritated by his manner. "In a short time, you'll be able to put your clothes back on and lead a normal life. Or don't you think our plans will work?
Yes, I think they will work.
Then why the crepe hanging?
Instead of answering directly, he said, Mr. Nivens, you don't think that a man with my pot belly enjoys running around without his clothes, do you?
I suppose not. As for myself, I'm beginning to find it pleasant. I may hate to have to give it up. Saves time, and it's comfortable.
You need not worry about having to give it up. This is a permanent change.
Huh? I don't get you.
You said our plans would work, and now you talk as if schedule suntan would go on forever.
In a modified way, it will.
I said, Pardon me? I'm stupid today.
He dialed for another beer.
Mr. Nivens, I never expected to live to see a military reservation turned into a ruddy nudist camp.
Having seen it happen, I never expect to see us change back, because we can't. Pandora's box has a one-way lid. All the king's horses and all the king's men.
Conceded, I answered.
Things never go back quite to what they were before.
Just the same, you are exaggerating. The day after the president rescinds schedule suntan, the suspended blue laws will go into effect, and a man without pants will be liable to arrest.
I hope not.
Huh? But make up your mind.
It's made up for me, Mr. Nivens. As long as there exists a possibility that a slug is alive, the polite man must be willing to bear his entire body on request, or risk getting shot. Not just this week and next week, but 20 years from now, or 100.
No, he said, seeing that I was about to interrupt. I'm not disparaging your fine plans, but pardon me if I say that you have been too busy with their details to notice that they are strictly local and temporary. For example, have you made any plans for combing the Amazon jungles, tree by tree?
He went on apologetically.
Just a rhetorical inquiry. This globe has nearly 60 million square miles of dry land. We can't begin to search it and clean out the slugs. Shucks, man, we haven't made a dent in the rats, and we've been at that a long time. Titans are trickier and more prolific than rats.
Are you trying to tell me it's hopeless? I demanded.
Hopeless? Not at all. Have another drink.
I'm trying to say that we are going to have to learn to live with this horror, the way we had to learn to live with the atom bomb.
I went away feeling dashed and not at all cocky. I wanted to find Mary.
Some days, it occurred to me, the genius business wasn't worth the trouble.
33.
We were gathered in the same conference room in the White House. It put me in mind of the night after the president's message many weeks before. Dad was there. So were Mary and Rexton and Martinez. None of the fishing cabinet was present, but their places were filled by our own lab general, by Dr. Hazelhurst, and by Colonel Gibbsy. Martinez was busy trying to restore his face after having been told that he'd been shunted out of the biggest show of his own department. Nobody paid him any attention. Our eyes were on the big map still mounted across one wall. It had been 4.5 days since the vector drop of schedule fever, but the Mississippi Valley still glowed in ruby lights. I was getting jittery, although the drop had been an apparent success, and we had lost only 3 craft. According to the equations, every slug within reach of direct conference should have been infected 3 days ago, with an estimated 23% overlap. The operation had been computed to contact about 80% of the slugs in the first 12 hours alone, mostly in the large cities. Soon, slugs should start dying a darn sight faster than flies ever did. If we were right. I forced myself to sit still and wondered whether those ruby lights covered a few million very sick slugs, or merely 200 dead apes. Had somebody skipped a decimal point, or blabbed, Or had there been an error in our reasoning so colossal that we could not see it? Suddenly a light blinked green, right in the middle of the board. Everybody sat up. Right on top of it, a voice began to come out of the stereo gear, though no picture built up.
This is Station Dixie, Little Rock.
A very tired southern voice said.
We need help very badly. Anyone who is listening, please be good enough to pass on this message. Little Rock, Arkansas is in the grip of a terrible epidemic. Notify the Red Cross. We have been in the hands of...
The voice trailed off. Whether from weakness or transmission failure, I could not be sure. I remembered to breathe. Mary patted my hand and I sat back, relaxing consciously. It was joy too great to be pleasure. I saw now that the green light had not been Little Rock, but farther west in Oklahoma. Two more lights blinked green, one in Nebraska and one north of the Canadian line. Another voice came over, a twangy New England voice. I wondered how he'd gotten into Zone Red.
A little like election night, huh, Chief? Martinez said heartily.
A little, the president agreed. But we do not usually get returns from Old Mexico. He pointed to the board. A pair of green lights were showing in Chihuahua.
By George, you're right. Well, I guess State will have some international incidents to straighten out when this is over, eh?
The president did not answer, and he shut up, to my relief. The president seemed to be talking to himself. He noticed me watching him, smiled, and spoke out loud.
"'Tis said that fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite 'em, and little fleas have lesser fleas, and so ad infinitum."
I smiled to be polite, though I thought the notion was gruesome under the circumstances. The president looked away and said,
"'Would anyone like supper? I find that I am hungry for the first time in days.'"
By late the next afternoon, the board was more green than red. Rexton had caused to be set up two annunciators, keyed into the command center in the new Pentagon. One showed percentage of completion of the completed score deemed necessary before the big drop. The other showed the projected time of drop. The figures on it changed from time to time, sometimes up, sometimes down. For the past 2 hours, they had been holding fairly steady around 1743 East Coast time. Finally, Rexton stood up.
"I'm going to freeze it at 1745, he announced. "Mr. President, if you will excuse me?"
"Certainly, sir." Rexton turned to Dad and myself. "If you two Don Quixotes are still determined to go, now is the time." I stood up. "Mary, you wait for me." She asked, "Where?" It had already been settled, and not peacefully, that she was not to go. The president interrupted.
"I suggest that Mrs. Niven stay here. After all, she is a member of the family."
With the invitation, he gave his best smile, and I said, "Thank you, sir." Colonel Gibbsy got a very odd look. 2 hours later, we were coming in on our target, and the jump door was open. Dad and I were last in line, after the kids who would do the real work. My hands were sweaty, and I stunk with the old curtain-going-up stink. I was scared as hell. I never liked to jump. 34. Gun in my left hand, antitoxin injector ready in my right, I went from door to door in my assigned block. It was an older section of Jefferson City, slums almost. It consisted of apartment houses built 50 years ago. I had given 24 injections and had 36 to go before it would be time for me to rendezvous at the State House. I was getting sick of it. I knew why I'd come. It was not just curiosity. I wanted to see them die. I wanted to watch them die. See them dead, with a weary hate that passed all of their needs. But now I had seen them dead, and I wanted no more of it. I wanted to go home, take a bath, and forget it. It was not hard work, just monotonous and nauseating. So far, I had not seen one live slug, though I had seen many dead ones. I had burned one skulking dog that appeared to have a hump. I was not sure, as the light had been bad. We had hit shortly before sundown, and now it was almost full dark. The worst of it was the smells. Whoever compared the odor of unwashed, lousy, diseased humans with that of sheep was no friend to decent sheep. I finished checking the rooms of the apartment building I was in, shouted to make sure, and went out into the street. It was almost deserted. With the whole population sick with a fever, we found few on the streets. The lone exception was a man who came weaving toward me, eyes vacant. I yelled, "Hey!" He stopped. I said, "You are sick, but I've got what you need to get well. Hold out your arm." He struck at me feebly. I hit him carefully with my gun, and he went face down. Across his back was the red rash of the slug. I avoided that area, picked a reasonably clean and healthy patch over his kidney, and stuck in the injector, bending it to break the point after it was in. The units are gas-loaded. Nothing more was needed. I did not even withdraw it, but left him. The first floor of the next house held 7 people, most of them so far gone that I did not bother to speak, but simply gave them their shots and hurried on. I had no trouble. The second floor was like the first. The top floor had 3 empty apartments, at one of which I had to burn out the lock to enter. The 4th flat was occupied, in a manner of speaking. There was a dead woman on the floor of the kitchen, her head bashed in. Her slug was still on her shoulders, but merely resting there, for it was dead too, and beginning to reek. I left them quickly and looked around. In the bathroom, sitting in an old-fashioned bathtub, was a middle-aged man. His head slumped on his chest, and his wrist veins were open. I thought he was dead, but he looked up as I bent over him. "You're too late," he said dully. "I killed my wife." Or too soon, I thought. From the appearance of the bottom of the tub and by his gray face, 5 minutes later would have been better. I looked at him, wondering whether or not to waste an injection. He spoke again. "My little girl." "You have a daughter?" I said loudly. "Where is she?" His eyes flickered, but he did not speak. His head slumped forward again. I shouted at him, then felt his jawline and dug my thumb into his neck, but could find no pulse. As a favor to him, I burned him carefully through the base of the brain before I left. The child was in a bed in one of the rooms, a girl of 8 or so, who would have been pretty had she been well. She roused and cried and called me Daddy. "Yes, yes," I said soothingly. "Daddy's going to take care of you." I gave her the injection in her leg. I don't think she noticed it. I turned to go, but she called out again.
"I'm thirsty. Want a drink of water?"
So I had to go back into that bathroom again. As I was giving it to her, my phone shrilled and I spilled some of it. "Son, can you hear me?" I reached for my belt and switched on my phone. "Yes, what's up?" "I'm in that little park just north of you. Can you come? I'm in trouble." "Coming." I put down the glass and started to leave. Then, caught by indecision, I turned back. I could not leave my new friend to wake up in that charnel house. A dead parent in each room. I gathered her up in my arms and stumbled down to the 2nd floor. There I entered the first door I came to, and laid her on a sofa. There were people in the flat. Probably too sick to bother with her, but it was all I could do. Hurry, son. I'm on my way. I dashed out of there and wasted no more breath talking to him, but made speed. Dad's assignment was directly north of mine, paralleling it and fronting on one of those pint-sized downtown parks. When I got around the block, I did not see him at first, and ran on past him. Here, son, over here, at the car. This time I could hear him, both through the phone and my bare ear. I swung around and spotted the car, a big Cadillac duo, much like the section often used. There was someone inside, but it was too dark for me to see whether or not it was the old man. I approached cautiously until I heard him say, "Thank God, I thought you would never come." And I knew it was he. I had to duck in to get through the door. It was then that he clipped me. I came to find my hands tied and my ankles as well. I was in the second driver's seat of the car, and the old man was in the other, at the controls. The wheel on my side was latched up, out of the way. The sudden realization that the car was in the air brought me fully awake. He turned and said cheerfully, "Feeling better?" I could see his slug, riding high on his shoulders. "Some better," I admitted. "Sorry I had to hit you," he went on, "but there was no other way.